Okay, morning everyone. What I'm going to present is definitely not a paper. It's more of a kind of stock-taking on the work that leads up to my component of this Urban Aspirations project. I'll also say a little bit about where I want to go with my component of it too, which has to do with the city of Solo or Surakarta in central Java. So the idea, I guess, here is to try to plug you into where I'm coming from, where I think I want to go to, in order to workshop some of the ideas which haven't been developed nearly as much as I would have liked to at this stage yet. So thinking about workshop as a verb, yeah, workshopping this work, right, such as it exists at the moment. So the starting point is some of my prior interest in urban policy in decentralized Indonesia. I've been interested in what's happening in cities in Indonesia in the context of political decentralization after the Suharto era, a period where cities and other third-tier political units, kabupaten or regencies, have been conferred a certain amount of regional autonomy and enlarged power and, to a certain extent, resources. Now, one of the things that I'm situating myself in, but also partly reacting against, I think, is the overwhelmingly negative way in which decentralized local government has been appraised, especially in much of the academic literature. So typically, local governments in decentralized Indonesia are seen as lacking capacity and resources to deliver services effectively. They're often characterized in terms of corruption rather than the predatory state of Suharto having been eradicated, corruption seen as having merely been rescaled to the level of the city, creating a bunch of mini Suhartos, as some people have talked about it. And perhaps more specifically, in some of the work, the critical political economy work, I'm characterizing this, I'm caricaturing it perhaps, but there seems to be a sense that decentralization is synonymous with or reducible to neoliberalization, a lot of critique that efforts, multilateral efforts to try to improve capacity or to make things better are somehow merely neo-institutionalist and are ignoring wider relations of power, obscuring political entanglements. So, I mean, I put the work of, I mentioned Betty Haddis, a former colleague in sociology, and I like and respect Betty's work a lot, so I have caricatured it here. But I think there is a danger that this kind of work does two things, which I put on the slide here. Firstly, that this very critical reading serves to obscure or deny the possibility of local governments as developmental or even progressive. And here, my thinking in relation to this echoes some of the things that Sue Parnell and Jenny Robinson have been writing about in the context of African cities as well. And then another component of this is that there seems to be a sense that the only kind of models that travel or are transferred are the ones which are lowest common denominator, business-friendly, neoliberal models. So one of the reasons why I've been drawn to Solo in particular, or Surakarta, is precisely because it's a city that has been storied in more positive ways and even seen as a model in various ways. I just thought I'd run through three of them here. The first one has to do with Solo as a city where people living along flood-prone riverbanks and in public spaces have been relocated in an equitable and peaceful way. You see some flood riverbank houses here. This is an image from a few years ago in the Banjarsari Monument Park with street vendors. So unlike the conditions in many other cities in Indonesia, including Surabaya, that Rita, of course, talked about yesterday, relocations have generally taken place in non-violent ways. And in the case of the image that you see here, in fact, there have been carnival processions where people have actually used a procession to move to the relocation sites. In this case, people moving from the banks of the Bengawan Solo, the river running through the city. And one of the reasons why things have happened in this way is that people who formerly did not hold land title along the river, for example, have been given land title in other parts of the city, as you see in the top image there. Assistance has been given for rebuilding of housing in these new locations. These are folks moving from Banjarsari, former street vendors who are being moved into a newly constructed marketplace. Other people who are resettled from the river moved into renovated traditional markets elsewhere in the city. So I realise that this alone, equitable relocation, doesn't necessarily sound like anything to get excited about. I guess the absence of violence itself in the context of Indonesia is worth noting. But another thing to bear in mind is that the top image here is the cleared site of the park at Banjarsari. The image doesn't show it, but it's actually still being used as a public park. I was the only foolish Englishman out in the midday sun. That's why there was no one else there when I took the photo. So the land's been cleared, but it's been cleared for public use. It hasn't been appropriated for the construction of a mall or some other commercial development. And similarly, along the river here, the waterfront land has not been appropriated for the construction of the kind of vision that we saw in Surabaya, or perhaps also along the waterfront in Edinburgh, but rather has been reworked as a park. So that's the first aspect, which has been perceived as a success story, if you like, in Solo. The second thing has to do, and I've hinted at this already, the upgrading of traditional markets, in some cases to house informal street vendors from public spaces. And I should also point out here more generally that the city government in Solo has introduced a series of regulations that restrict the opening and expansion of so-called modern retailers, from mini marts, right through to hypermarkets and shopping malls. And so there's a possibility I might actually end up doing some work with Neil Coe again after a long time now that he's moved back here. And the third thing to rush through that's been seen as positive about Solo has to do with the fact that the city government has been quite welcoming of and has encouraged the flourishing of participatory planning through civil society organisations. So the image here is from the website of Solo Kota Kita, an organisation that I'm partly working with in this research. The guy on the far right, Afwad, is one of my research assistants. The image at the bottom here is from a digital atlas which is produced by Solo Kota Kita. What they basically do is they work with communities to try to assess the assets and also the needs of communities, so that people in those communities can then go into the annual participatory budgeting meetings with a clearer sense of what they might actually do with funds, so that they can participate more actively and meaningfully in the existing participatory budgeting meetings. Coming into this Urban Aspirations project, having done some work in Solo, I've been interested in how and why these kinds of initiatives took root, ROOT, in Solo, and also thinking about how some of these initiatives have travelled their routes, ROUTES. Maybe I should say routes, able to distinguish in terms of US pronunciation. So hence the routes, routes, routes framing of the abstract that I submitted for the workshop. So let me just run through routes and routes, if you like. So if you ask pretty much anyone in Indonesia what accounts for the success, or the so-called success, of Solo, they will almost all say it's because of now former Mayor Jokowi. There's no doubt this is a remarkable individual, charismatic, and incredible commitment to scores and scores of public meetings to resolve some of these issues. And I think in both word and deed, he was able to foster a sense that his policies and developmental aims were people-centred. So there's this phrase, Pembangunan Nuwangke Uwang, which is very much associated with Jokowi today. But of course, as a critical academic, we always like to move beyond the commonly accepted explanation for success stories. I think it's important to put Jokowi in context as mayor. So there's a long history of radical politics in Surakarta, not always progressive radical politics, perhaps. He's part of a political party whose political base in the city included socioeconomically marginal groups. And perhaps most importantly, something which has been erased from the way in which solo has often been written about in recent years, including much academic work. The city of Solo was acknowledged as a forerunner in the reform movement prior to the election of Jokowi as mayor in 2006. So it's interesting that he's associated with this term, Pemanggonan Nuanke Uang. But actually, it was someone in the local government in 2001 who coined this term before Jokowi was ever elected. So that's roots, R-O-O-T-S. Roots, R-O-U-T-S. How has Solo travelled? In what ways is Solo travelling as a model? Well, in part, although he's no longer mayor, Solo travels through Jokowi. This image is taken from the Gramedia bookstore in Solo. I guess that's kind of unrepresentative, but I assure you, if you went to Gramedia bookstores elsewhere in Indonesia, you'd find lots of books about Jokowi, doing things the Jokowi way, leadership the Jokowi way, even city management the Jokowi way. Wait for it, this is another Royal Connection, you're going to love this one. So this is a book about adopting the habits of great leaders. Yeah, so it's Sukarno, Jokowi, Queen Elizabeth, Warren Buffett, can you believe it? And Albert Einstein. I bet they've never been put together in one image before. It's a great image, huh? Speaking about things that could make for a paper. Right. So the reason why Jokowi is no longer mayor of Solo is that in late last year he was elected to become governor of Jakarta, something that Rita's also looking at in her research. So in a way, one of the ways in which Solo has travelled elsewhere is through Jokowi's own political mobility, and interestingly from a provincial city to the national capital, which sort of inverts the way in which people usually imagine ideas as travelling. So ideas from Solo are now being taken up in modified form through Jokowi in Jakarta. So apart from Jokowi himself, there's all kinds of profiles of good practice, both domestically and internationally. An image here on the slide is from a kind of collection of these kinds of stories, including Solo, from an organization called Apexi. And internationally too, we've seen Solo vaunted as a model and taken up by, amongst other places, the municipality of Phraket in Greater Bangkok. And Eric and I are going to be looking at either end of this, the Solo Phraket best practice route or route, if you like. So inevitably, the profile, high profile of Jokowi and these best practice profilings from organisations like Apexi and Delgosi mean that Solo has attracted a large number of study tours, both from within, from cities and other regencies within the island of Java, and also elsewhere in Indonesia, and also internationally, including, as we put up there, to Phraket in Greater Thailand. Study tours, study banding, kunka, some of those as they're sometimes called, as in the cases that Mark was talking about yesterday, have often been labelled as junkets in the media in Indonesia. So, following the policy mobilities work that Kevin and Eugene McCann, amongst others, have contributed so much to, we're thinking about this not just in terms of what goes on at either end of a route, but thinking more generally about something that he alluded to in the previous presentation about relationality and territoriality. As Kevin has done, I think it's really important for us looking at Solo to complicate a simple dichotomy between the local or localized historical roots, R-O-O-T-S, of the supposedly successful transformation of Solo on the one hand, and subsequent extra-local routes of policy on the other. So we might problematize that at both ends, if you like. So rather than seeing aspects of Solo's development as emerging from some kind of local grounded context, we can see that Jokowi himself is often referring to experiences that he had overseas and ideas that he's tried to implement from overseas. Local government study tours took place from local government officials to the Philippines before Jokowi came to power regarding participatory governance. which again complicates that story. Is everything good as having been initiated by Chakoa himself? And there's been various kinds of technical input from domestic and international agencies, for example, over the reconstruction and the relocation sites. And looking at things the other way around, there's no wholesale transfer. Kevin has a problem with the term transfer, yeah? of the solo model to cities elsewhere. We recognise that policies take root in and are shaped through social and political contexts. And so in the case of the kind of work that Eric and I are thinking about doing, we'll definitely be looking at the kind of politics that led up to the Praked study tour of solo, as well as the subsequent mutation of the solo model in that context. So when I was preparing the slides, I was thinking, well, actually, perhaps all this can be understood and examined in terms of relationality and territoriality. Why persist with the whole routes, routes framing? Well, there are two reasons whether I'll continue to persist with these is a different matter. The first one is that I like botanical metaphors. I know a lot of people groaned yesterday at POD. A lot of people liked it as well, Daniel, don't worry. But I'm quite interested in the notion of grass routes, grass, R-O-U-T-E-S, right? So rather than the grass roots that was popularized by people like Castells. And part of this has to do with the fact that the notion of grass roots, as it currently exists, really works for the in-situ growth of a single grass plant, and it works for the way in which potentially grass reproduces asexually. But grass plants, I assure you, because I've looked into this now, grass plants also reproduce sexually in ways which I think lend themselves to thinking about dispersal and mutation, which could work for the study of, say, dispersal, mutation of urban policy. But the second reason why I'm tempted to persist with root stroke routes is because I'm also keen to move beyond strictly urban policy and elite actors and agents. I know in Helen's work yesterday, she was talking about the mobility of particular programs rather than policy per se, right? And this is just, it sounds awful to sort of quote something from the workshop you co-organised, but this is what we actually put on the in the write-up for the workshop, in case you haven't read it. To date, relational territorial studies of cities have focused on those who make policy rather than the lived experiences, aspirations and capacities of ordinary urbanites. Although, as Kevin pointed out, in some cases, of course, these are the same people. And Kevin, in some of his recent work, has been keen to use the term policy actors. And I think part of that is about moving beyond strict state understandings of policy makers to incorporate and to think about a wider range of policy experts. But I'm in my component of this project, I'm quite keen to move even beyond that, I think, to consider those, as I put it here, who experience the consequences of policy and those who strive to remake urban spaces and lives, if not the city, from below. I haven't looked at you at all. Am I already over time?
3 minutes,
okay, to do half my presentation, great. What I've decided to do is to, and I haven't got very far yet, is to examine the route, stroke, routes, the territorial relational dimensions of one of the communities resettled from the banks of the Bungama Solo River in Solo, in Surakarta. And it's, is there a point on this? How do I do it? Oh, the green button, okay. So, in particular, a group that are resettled from Bujang Sawit along the river here. The river runs along the border, actually, of the city of Solo, and this group were resettled further north. As in the earlier cases, they moved procession style. It's not just because they're showing how happy they are, it's also bound up with Javanese traditional practices conferring good fortune on the resettlement site, which I don't claim to understand fully. They were given land title at the relocation site. Here's the entrance to the relocation site, and one of the pathways leading through the relocation site. So the questions that I'm starting from are the ones that I highlighted in the introduction yesterday. So I won't elaborate on those now, but I just want to finish by talking about three sets of issues that arise from me seeking to move from these general questions that frame the Urban Aspirations Project to my more site-specific field work. And I wish I had the benefit of listening to Kevin's presentation before I prepared these, because they do speak to some of the broader issues about methodology and wider issues from the workshop. So the first has to do with something which I flagged yesterday, especially after listening to Mark's presentation, a methodological issue about tracing back site or community development. I'm really interested in the histories of individual and community engagement with local government, especially during Jokowi's time as mayor. But actually doing that, I've come up against all kinds of obstacles, not least in terms of just finding out what happened at these meetings. I've got some video footage, much of it is in Javanese, which I don't speak at all, rather than Indonesian, even that's a struggle to understand in some of these meetings. There are no transcripts of the meetings. So what I'm left with is memories of engagement and met or unmet aspirations, rather than examination of the ongoing process. At the same time, as Kevin just alluded to as well, I think there are really important insights to be derived from looking backwards, not least to find themes that you might wish to explore in taking forward. So land titling is clearly very significant here, and how that relates to issues of urban citizenship, the merits and demerits of different forms of tenure, that debate between, basically everybody who criticises De Soto, and of course power relations about registration, so who is actually holding the certificate when people are titled, not least gender dimensions here. There are also important issues around the provision of sites and spaces of worship, and it's worth noting that the resettlement community is almost exactly 50-50 in its composition between Christians and Muslims. But the point I tried to suggest yesterday is that in tracing back, it's difficult to get into the mundane, incremental emergence and reworking of aspirations around such issues. And so the second thing has to do with the importance, I think, of tracking forward, not necessarily in real time, as Kevin just called it, right? The aspirations and material transformations in this site. So we have to avoid this notion that people in the resettlement site came into the negotiations with fully formed senses of what they wanted from the process of relocation and in their new site. Imagined possibilities and ways of realizing them emerged, and in some cases are closed over time. And that's the kind of thing I want to try to connect to over the next 2 or 3 years in process. Who are the kinds of people to draw upon in thinking about how to do this kind of work? Well, definitely Malik Simone, who was mentioned yesterday. Who was it was talking about Malik Simone? Elaine, yes. I find his work frustrating and inspirational in equal measure, but definitely suggestive in all kinds of ways. But he talks about the politics of increments, speculative anticipations, an emphasis on incremental dimensions of change and possibility. What do I get from reading this? Well, we really require forms of ethnographic engagement that may be beyond me, not least in terms of time. But there's a need for forms of collaboration, in my case with Solo Kotakita and the guy that I pointed out. So he's my eyes and ears on the ground, but that's still not the same as being there, right? That's my compensation in the way that Elaine's compensation is social media. And then finally, I'm sorry, I really have gone over time. Something else I mentioned, I think also in relation to Elaine's presentation, has to do with conceptualizing aspiration. Although we've drawn heavily upon Apadurai, I think we only get so far with that because Apadurai is actually quite vague about how aspiration relates to or differs from other terms such as agency, action. I think one way to consider this is to conceptualize aspiration as a capacity to imagine possibilities. At the risk of enraging Daniel, who hates the term agency altogether, but it's a form of agency which is intertwined with but different from action. And in terms of this notion of trying to plug into emergent or incremental change, I'm interested in thinking about how aspiration is a capacity that can be exercised and fostered incrementally. What does this mean in the case of this resettlement site at Pujang Mojo? Well, I think it means thinking about how people are learning to aspire, learning to make the most of new opportunities from a relatively conducive political context. I wanted to end on a hopeful note. There might be a virtuous circle between action and aspiration. I don't think it's ever going to be as simple as that. So what do I want to do methodologically over the next couple of years? I'll be looking often through the eyes of my research assistant at community deliberations, how diverse individuals relate to those deliberations, and how community representatives engage with wider political structures, for example, the sub-districts of which these annual participatory budgeting meetings take place. Okay, thank you.